Welcome to Access Ideas, where we share insights and perspectives that spark curiosity, conversation, and inspiration. I'm Yana, and today we're spicing up the e-commerce conversation with Diana Burson, co-founder of DownPay. Picture this, snagging that dreamy custom couch or hot new tech solution without paying all up front. That's where DownPay comes in, turning your shopping dreams into reality with payment plans that don't break the bank. Diana's journey from her Shopify days to launching DownPay is nothing short of inspiring. She saw a gap in how online shops engage with their customers, especially in the custom goods market, and turned that insight into an e-commerce revolution. DownPay not only eases the financial pinch, but also boosts online sales by up to 30%, proving that a little flexibility goes a long way. And why else will you want to hear this? Because Diana's story is a blend of tech savvy, entrepreneurial spirit, and a dash of making the impossible possible. We'll dive into how DownPay is reshaping e-commerce one payment at a time, and how it's creating happier customers and more confident sellers. From her days at Shopify to redefining the e-commerce landscape, Diana's story unfolds with enlightening takeaways, genuine laughter, and the excitement that comes from seeing someone redefine the norms. Whether you're into tech, run your own business, or just love hearing how ideas come to life, you won't want to miss this. Let's jump in and discover how DownPay is crafting the future of shopping online. And now I bring you Diana. Diana, welcome to Access Ideas. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited. Thanks for inviting me. I've heard so much about your podcast and just started listening. So it's great.
Thank you. Thank you. That's high praise. I'm very pleased. Maybe for getting started today, we have a variety of listeners. I'm sure some of them are like me and they shop online for everything. E-commerce is second nature. And then there's other people who don't want to use it at all. And then we've got business owners who might be thinking about launching their own e-commerce site, but maybe they're intimidated. So there's a real cross-section of listeners. Maybe we can start out by defining what e-commerce is right now. And can you explain in simple terms how it's changing the way we shop?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the space I'm very well versed in, working in it for the last decade or more. E-commerce has really become this amazing place to explore businesses around the world, to explore products that you may have never considered, and making it very accessible to a wide variety of audiences, right? And so it's a huge benefit and opportunity for business owners to be able to get traction across markets that maybe they'd never even considered. And I think the way it's really just like, it's moving so quickly. It's not been around for that long. Shopify itself has been working on this since early 2000s. And that's not really saying much for like a whole industry being around for two decades, right? So just seeing it, how it evolves, and seeing social commerce now, like all these really interesting influencers and like all these people building brands and building this loyal fan base that wants to buy products that solve a problem or like makes people feel a certain way. I just think, yeah, it's a really cool opportunity to like explore way more than just like jumping into stores and hopefully finding something that you need, right? So it's, I mean, I don't know if that covers e-commerce in its whole, you know, potential, but it's a little
great
something.
Starting point. That's a great start. And I think for some people, they might think, oh, that's just for big companies. E-commerce is only for companies who have a whole team, or I'm a small business owner and I couldn't really use it. Now, obviously, people who use Shopify know that's not the case, but let's clarify that for people who are unclear. E-commerce is really available to anyone at this point. You can be a solopreneur. Like you mentioned, social e-commerce is a huge thing. What do you think is different now with the fact that we have more solopreneurs or social media e-commerce available to us? That also means we have products that wouldn't be mass produced. We have products for sale that could be one of a kind, distinct. artisan products, custom made. And I'm getting into, of course, the downpay territory here, but let's talk a little bit about that. What has Shopify and other companies enabled with e-commerce that is so liberating for business owners or people who want to sell a product or service?
Yeah, I mean, what gets me really excited about it, you know, back 20 years ago, you had the big companies hiring a huge agency to custom make a website and like have all this, all their products available and, you know, everything for customers to check out and everything. And that was like, that was the only people that could afford being able to do it. And now you have companies like Shopify, like Etsy, which is a marketplace, you know, really democratizing, you know, commerce and making it available to people that potentially don't want to be experts in how checkout works and don't want to like sit down and really try to like build a website from scratch and, you know, all this stuff. Like they are artisans. They are people with great ideas that want to build something and share that passion with customers out there that don't necessarily want to worry about the tech and just want to make sure that it works and, you know, it gets their product from, you know, their home to whoever is buying it. And so I think like that it's just like the barrier to entry has just become so much less. And by doing that, you have people with just like any idea out there able to share it with the world. Like the social commerce thing is, you know, building a following. I follow a lot of makers on Instagram and everything. And I marvel at the artistry that there is out there. And now instead of saying, you know, these people are sharing just images of their work, they're able to share the experience of owning one of the products that they've built and get their name out there and not have to worry about, you know, $100,000 investment into building a website, processing payments, shipping out products. Like it's just become so easy that anybody can start, really.
And that's a great breaking off point for who is your potential customer. You founded Downpay after immense experience at Shopify. So you really understand the e-commerce space quite well. Who is your ultimate customer end user, the people who would want to use Downpay? Is there quite a variety or are you targeting a more specific market?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're really early on our journey and, you know, we're not kicking anyone out of bed because we see that our product does solve problems for a variety of different industries. So there's tons of people launching pre-orders. So, you know, I have the latest game or I have the latest, you know, my book or something, and I want to gauge demand. I want to see like how many are actually going to need to be produced. Right. And so you have, you know, our app able to take a deposit or defer payment altogether until the product is shipped, which is amazing because now you're making it way more affordable for people to show you that they're interested, but also gaining more like securing that actual order because people have to, you know, put their money, like put their credit card down at least to say, I'm interested, you know, let me know when it's out, charge my card later, that kind of thing. So you have that whole pre-order space, which like I expected, you know, like I was like, these are the people, these are my people. But the emerging kind of industry and like the group of people that we actually target more and see they get the most value out of it is these personalized custom made to order kind of, you know, businesses. And so think about furniture stores that sell, you know, a couch in 40 different colors with different fabrics and all that stuff. And so easy to make that work in a physical space, right? You're talking to somebody, you're picking your stuff, and they just place the order for you. It's super custom. And it's now become so much easier to do that online, to say, here's a photo of the 4 different colors. Here's this, here's that. The build time is, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. Just leave us a 30% deposit and we'll process your order. Nobody wants to wait 6 to 8 weeks and pay up front because, you know, it's really expensive as the world is becoming more expensive. So that's like the really interesting. I didn't think that there was so many businesses out there doing personalizations, customizations, and it's really starting to take off with like how many more engaged customers they get when they're able to say, we actually only need this much to get into production. The rest we'll charge you when we ship, which is it's a no-brainer once you really think about it.
Yes, yes. And you're solving a problem that a lot of creators and artisans have, which is, how do I sell my creations, my merchandise, in a way that I am paid fairly? I maybe don't have a warehouse or a place to pay for storage. And at the same time, you've also mentioned, Diana, the challenge of just gauging interest. A product that might only have a prototype or one version, and DownPay enables potential customers to indicate their interest. Can you tell us a little bit more how that works? So if I'm somebody who has created a product or wants to create a product, and I advertise that, and potential customers indicate their interest, how would that work for DownPay? How does DownPay play a role?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I just got off a call with a potential customer just now about, you know, running a pre-sale on a new product. And it's really as simple as that. Like, you're, you know, doing all the efforts that you can to market yourself out, to like build a brand, to get people excited. And, you know, a lot of them focus on social media to really gather that audience, just make sure. And as people get excited, you know, you start releasing information like, hey, we're just about to launch this, you know, pre-sale campaign. We want to, like, we will go into production if we sell this many units, you know, get yours today kind of thing. And a lot of them actually do $0 deposits. So they say, listen, like, you still have to put a credit card down, but we're only going to charge you if we go into production. And this is just really showing us that you're really interested, that you want to support us, so on and so forth. And I think it's like, we see a lot of companies doing the whole waitlist thing. And I don't know if you've bumped into it, but I have, and I have like very little trust in it. Like, I've put myself on so many waitlists where I'm like, tell me when the product's back, and I never hear back. And I'm just like, well, that's not so useful.
Yeah. Years later, right?
Yeah. Years later, I'm like, oh, good, it's back. Like, at that point, I've given up on it. Or
you found an alternative.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, like, and yeah, like, not to say that in every situation you can take a transaction and say, we're going to get it to you eventually. But like, for the ones where you know there's huge demand and you're just waiting like the month or two to produce the next batch, wouldn't you rather just actually say, just check out and we'll send it to you and charge you when you get it? And you're like, okay, that's locked in. Like, they're going to process the sale as soon as it's back, versus tell me that it's back in stock and have me go back to checkout and hopefully get it again, right? Like, this is like, taking a deposit is like a real wait list where your priority matters, because you've actually said, I'm engaged, I completed my order. Now it's like, nobody can bump me from that, you know, that space. So yeah, that's like kind of the customers would just go through, check out as normal, and then we would store their card on file for the merchant to be able to process when they need to.
And I assume there's some built-in lag time. So if that person's card expires in a certain amount of time, then they might be having to provide a different card up front to ensure that the merchant is paid with an active credit card by the time payment comes out.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, we're working on a ton of features where we make it a lot easier to say, oh, like, payment failed, like, update your payment method. And we have a customer portal available for customers that they can just go in proactively and update the card on file. So if it expired or they know that something happened, it's very easy for them to just find their order, change the card on file, and now they don't have any risk of, you know, potentially losing their order, right? So it's like, very easy to build these systems as well with e-commerce, and just kind of give the power to the customer while the merchant just focuses on production, or, you know, like, kind of everything else to run their business.
Can you share a success story or an example of a merchant who might not have sold their products, or maybe wouldn't have experienced success, but they started using DownPay?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was maybe end of last year. No, actually, sorry. It was like the end of summer of last year. We got in contact with this company in Denmark called Uno, and they were launching the 2.0 version of this in-car little device that they have available in Denmark. And it basically warns you if there's accidents ahead, you know, lets you know if there's like speed cameras, you know, like that whole thing. And they were really interested in doing a, like, a basically a couple of launches for selling the full production line. And so we helped them build out some custom systems that helped do the payment collection later on. And, you know, so all the technical stuff that needs to happen to process mass orders. But the reason it was so interesting was because they came to us and said, hey, listen, like, we don't have exact dates for when our production's going to be ready, when we're going to ship out. And in Europe, in a lot of countries in Europe, it's actually illegal to sell something, collect payment up front when you don't have an accurate date. If you pre-order, it has to be exactly when you say it's going to get delivered. So when it's unknown, they needed a way to not charge, you know, up front and then charge just when they ship. And so that's like the example I gave you of like this $0 deposit, this deferred payment, where you just take the order, people are locked in, they're ready to go, and you only charge right when shipping happens. Let me just pull it up here because I don't remember what their stats were, but it was like they sold a lot of things. So they did 3 drops, but in their first one, they sold 50,000 units in 23 hours.
Whoa.
So it was...
And this is just in Denmark, or was it in Europe in general?
Oh, well, I think it might have been in all of Europe, but it's a Denmark, like a company based in Denmark. So it was, I think, 2 million units sold worldwide in 23 hours. And all of them had deferred payments, which was really cool. And then they did another 2 drops after that. And that was like the run that they did. It was very successful. And it was like, we were a young company, and they were just so flexible with like, okay, yeah, let's make this work, you know, let's scale things up. And yeah, things were really great. So,
and I think what's notable too, beyond that phenomenal first success, it's extraordinary, is the fact this is in Denmark. So listeners might be thinking, oh, well, I'm in this other location, and you, Diana, are in Ottawa, which is where I am as well. Great place.
Yep.
Do you feel like your experience at Shopify helped expedite your understanding of some of the regulatory frameworks or restrictions that might be in place for payments around the world? And so you already had that insight that you could work with global sellers, e-commerce providers anywhere. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because some people might feel like their location could restrict them in some way if they're not used to some of the ways e-commerce works.
Absolutely. So, I mean, for us, there are a few limitations in terms of like the payment gateway we work with. So Shopify has tons of payment gateways you can use. Some countries use local payment gateways. And so we only support, like at this time, we only support PayPal, and we support Shopify Payments, which is like the main one that Shopify ships with. But Shopify Payments is only available in certain countries. It's growing, it's getting bigger, but it is something to consider. However, most of Europe, you know, has Shopify Payments. So it varies, of course, and it's very easy to find that information. But it did really help. Like, it helped me really build the right solution for people. When I first started this whole app development journey, I worked at Shopify for 6 years, and I left, I think, back in 2021. And, you know, during that time, it was just, yeah, I got super exposed to like every aspect of what it means to sell a product on Shopify. And I ended my journey in checkout.
Amazing. Maybe we can pause there, because you left after one of the most transformational eras, of course. I'm talking about the C or the P word, depending on who you are, pandemic and COVID. This was, of course, the era that so many of us turned to e-commerce and online shopping because of the restrictions in place. What did you learn during that time, Diana, that really transformed your understanding of the space? And what did you take with you when you founded DownPay?
Yeah, I mean, it was really sad and cool to work during this time. Like, it was like the boom of e-commerce, you know, like it was insane. I don't know if you remember how much Shopify was valued during that time. It was insane. And so we were building so fast. We were just like hustling to get features out. And so some of the learnings were, if you remember the supply chain delays that were so brutal, and it exacerbated all the struggles that merchants like Shopify merchants were dealing with. You know, they had a bunch of orders for super popular products like you know, there was this like outdoor pizza oven that everybody was obsessed with during the pandemic.
I remember that.
Yeah. And so like these products started trending, you know, while people were stuck at home, but the merchants were struggling to keep up because they couldn't get their shipments in from, you know, across the ocean. And so then they had canceled orders because they're taking payment up front. And they're like, is there no way to just do partial payments? Is there no way? And so we started seeing these things. And I mean, it's why, you know, I ended my journey at Shopify in checkout working on enabling technology to do the concept of partial payments, right? And so like, yes, I have kind of a hack in terms of like, starting a business because I knew this stuff and I built this stuff originally when I was there. But, you know, 2 years later, when I actually started building DownPay, those problems were still there. Like the supply chain never really fixed itself. It never really was resolved.
Recovered.
And there's, yeah, it didn't recover. And I think what happened also was you had a lot more businesses who are really interested in doing just-in-time production versus... Yes. I'm going to manufacture 30,000 of these things and hope they sell. And so learned a lot from, especially in fashion and apparel, learned a lot from businesses in Europe as well that were, yeah, hoping to just not cut fabric and make sizes, right?
I mean, that was such an interesting time for fashion specifically, because all these people like me who previously would have worn corporate wardrobes to the office.
Yeah.
Suddenly had pajamas and sweatpants and yoga pants as our main wardrobe. And so we were spending so much less on clothing in general. And the clothing we did buy was a lot more comfort oriented. You know, it was a sort of the sweatpants era.
Exactly. I mean, I'm in sweatpants right now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, exactly. Same. So the fashion industry in particular, I can see where this would have been especially relevant, because you've got all of a sudden an industry that has been oriented around mass production and shipping these enormous quantities to a sudden standstill and people just not even wanting the product anymore. Talk a little bit more about that, sort of how your perception and how you've seen production and supply chain impact payments, and maybe vice versa too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, there was like, it's a shame because I'm sure, and I still think now a lot of people mass produce and like build too much and end up basically just heavily discounting things to clear their stock. And I think I'm optimistic and eager for the world to change and to become more of a just-in-time production kind of space where human beings can be a bit more patient to getting their products and getting and only paying, and you know, when they receive them. It's the world I'm trying to build where, you know, we are less of a fast fashion kind of, you know, society and everything. And I do think really interesting thing that happened in e-commerce, especially after seeing all the supply chain stuff, was like the brands that were selling on Shopify, like the ones that you know by name, they're building higher quality products, they're building less of them, they're doing pre-sales, they're doing, you know, they're testing the waters before committing to something, like you said, right? Like I don't know the last time I bought like dress pants. And so there's just certain
or hard
things.
Pants. We like to call them hard pants.
Yeah, exactly. So they're, I think, getting a little bit more interested in sustainability, which is really great. And I think customers are looking for that angle as well, which is, it just builds more loyalty towards the brands that care about the environment, care about, you know, not throwing away so much. And all the studies came out over those couple of years about how much fast fashion is impacting, you know, the waste that's in the world.
Yeah. There's that famous spot in Chile with the like giant landfill that's just basically clothes that have been dumped in the desert. I think it was set on fire recently, and there was all these air pollution warnings. I mean,
yeah,
it's mind-boggling. But I think what I especially love about DownPay is you're, by design, you're supporting sustainability. You're supporting producers, creators who simply wouldn't have the capacity to create large outputs. And you're also supporting consumers who want to buy unique or interesting products and they don't have the money or the access to a really specialized, expensive product. So it's a very fascinating intersection of these three values. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, was that something that was always deliberate for you, or was it, were some of those features nice to have and you kind of, you realized it halfway through? Talk a little bit about the intersection of your values and down pay and founding that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I was super passionate about sustainability when I was developing this product, you know, thinking about fashion, of course, thinking about industries where too much is produced without gauging demand, without knowing anything. But the other aspect of it for me that's, I just like, I'm very rah-rah about lately has been affordability. Like, our bills keep going up. I would love this beautiful couch, but, you know, you're asking me for way too much money up front. And so, you know, if you're not familiar with the Buy Now, Pay Later apps that were once again boomed during the pandemic, the concept is that they would give you interest-free loans to buy something now and then pay it off over time, right? Like super standard loan-based things. Typically, products that are, you know, $10, $20, they're $0 interest pay in four. Usually they advertise like pay in four. And that's well and good. Like, that's great for a consumer. But the thing that changed during the pandemic was these apps would charge a minimum fee to the merchant. They would charge like near zero. So like 1%, 2%, whatever. They work with banks, and so they get loans, and so they have to track interest based on the interest, the actual prime rate. And so prime rate now is so high that merchants, whenever a customer uses Try Before You Buy, gets charged 5 to 11% on every transaction. And so that's on top of, like, you know, any platform's transaction fees as well. But because it looks so appealing to customers, right? It's like, oh, wow, like paying four for $0. You know, you have more people using it because they want to, you know, improve affordability. But you have merchants going, oh my goodness, like, this is so expensive, but it seems like we have to have it, you know? And so there's this whole, yeah, this whole area that I'm trying to really like push towards, which is like not having predatory pricing, and also just like making sure that we still help customers pay for the things they want in the timeline that they want, and not feel like you're giving up something to the actual store that you're buying from. I think a lot of people don't recognize that that's actually what's going on the back end. And so, yeah, that changed a lot during the pandemic. And like the popularity of Buy Now, Pay Later is still huge. But I think there's an opportunity there to just try to help make things more affordable for both sides. Because, yeah, this is like, if you, let's say, buy a couch for $3,000 on Buy Now, Pay Later, even the customer pays 15% interest on those payments. So now that's predatory, right? And that makes me like uncomfortable. I would never sign up for it if I didn't have to, right? But some people might if they really need something. So just trying to build a better balance there. And I think like that's a huge part of my value. Like, I don't want people to overstretch themselves. I know some people have to, but if there's anything I can build towards a path that helps with affordability and helps with sustainability, like, I'm there. I will do everything I can because it makes me get up and build a great company, you know?
Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about your experience with Shopify, your experience in the tech world, how you navigated the challenges and opportunities that you saw. Of course, you know, we've heard all about the stories of Shopify during the pandemic era, but talk a little bit about your overall experience in the tech world, and whether as a woman, whether as somebody who didn't plan to be an e-commerce co-founder.
Yeah.
I want to hear it all. Tell us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't start in tech. You know, in high school, I wanted to be an illustrator, and I was like obsessed with art. But I like pivoted into film and television in my final year, went to film school, did that whole tour, worked in film for several years, worked at CTV for a couple years in sound design. And it was great. until I recognized that just the schedule that it provided me was not something I was really excited about. Cutting ads and promos and stuff, I'm like, it's fun for a while and like you get to, you know, get creative. But I started recognizing that I was just not learning enough like on the job. And so that's kind of when I pivoted into tech careers. I ended up in the IT department at CTV building the sound studios that we were using, which was really cool. Like across Canada, I worked with people, like radio studios as well. So I got like really excited by like having this niche of knowledge and like learning it and building it really well.
And throughout this whole time, you would have been significantly appreciating the creative process and the contribution of creators, starting out with high school, being an illustrator. Now, I myself started out in fashion design. I went to school for fashion design.
Oh, nice.
So I really relate to the illustration piece and I love that. But I think this is significant because this is where it will come back when you're founding DownPay and you're understanding the point of view, the perspectives of the creator, the people who are creating the products, the services. But let's continue. So you were at CTV. Yeah. The schedule was just totally not conducive to having any personal wellness or health or sleep.
Yeah, it was a lot of night shifts.
A lot of night shifts. Probably pretty repetitive to some extent. Yeah. And then so what sparked your interest in the tech world in Shopify?
Yeah, it was, you know, at the time, I think Bell was really taking over CTV and things were just changing a lot. And, you know, I was at the point in my career where I wanted more challenge. I feel like every step of my career journey will be, and then I wanted to do more, or then I wanted to learn more. So you'll hear that a ton.
Nice.
So my mentor and friend at the time, she actually had just put in her notice and left CTV. And she's like, but by the way, I just saw this posting from Shopify, you know, for IT, like an IT career. Why don't you apply? And I'm like, what's a Shopify? Did not know anything about e-commerce. I had sold things on eBay. I'm like, at least I knew that. And so I took the opportunity. Like I got the interviews. They were amazing. I got to see the Toronto office. I was living in Toronto at the time. And they flew me to Ottawa to do like 4 interviews with like everyone. It was a crazy day. And I fell in love with the company. It was just this tech darling, right? And yeah, I got in there and really just focused on IT. Like I built a lot of the systems back in the day, you know, how to manage devices in like a 1,000+ company and so on and so forth, and kind of leveled things up. Pivoted again to security, wanting to learn more, like not wanting to do the same things I had just done for CTV. So that was kind of like the move to, you know, getting more and more deeper and deeper into Shopify and what it was. Still an internal team, right? Still a team that is part of a cost center instead of a cost reducer. You know what I mean? A
revenue generator.
That sounds better.
I know what you meant.
Yeah. But I learned a lot there too. And that's when I first had my first taste of product development and actually getting into like a revenue generating, you know, team. I was working on merchant login at the time and like trying to really make it secure, you know, do this massive migration, make design decisions with like a UX team and everything. And I was like, wow, like what is this job? And I didn't really have like, I don't remember what my title was at the time, but it was like, I didn't realize that what I was doing was being a product manager and making decisions that really impacted how somebody uses tech and how Shopify in general would be impacted from like an external point of view. And so yeah, at that point, it was a really difficult decision because I was trying to get the product manager title in the security team, which was like so new. They were like, we don't have that, you know, and I'm just dying to get a mentor, right? To teach me this career path, to teach me, you know, what to do. And I made the difficult decision to actually leave the security team and move into a real product team.
What was that like? It must have been a real culture shock.
It was. I mean, it was also like, it was really hard because in my head, I was like, it's so simple. Just like report me into the product org. Like, why is this so hard? And I'm like, yeah, there's like obviously more to that than, you know, than I thought. And then, yeah, moving into it, it was like night and day, you know, like people who work in revenue generating teams like have to work in different ways. Like timelines are different. There's expectations that, you know, like the way you track metrics on projects, you know, all these things were like completely new to me. And like the biggest thing that was super new to me was like convincing people that it's the right thing to do, that it's the right thing to build, and like building a muscle that makes you stand by your ideas. And like why this over this was just like one of the hardest things I had to learn, because it was
like advocating and influencing, championing your own ideas was a much steeper climb than it would have been in the past, because it's kind of like in the past with security, it's like, okay, is it within the realm of services that we have a budget for? Yes. Okay, let's do it. Yep. Whereas now you're up against a bunch of other product developers who each have their own ideas and they're all jostling for approval and resources.
You have only so many teams, and you know, then you have to figure out, you know, whether your leadership is like on the same page, if they had expected, you know, a certain thing to go out over another. So it was really, really hard, and I think it was one of the hardest lessons I had to learn that probably really helped me become a founder, because you can't build it all and you have to be very particular. But yeah, there's obviously a lot of bias too with like what people want to see delivered versus what they don't. So like the non-sexy infrastructure work that has to be done, you have to fight a lot harder for it because it takes longer. Merchants don't really see it, right? Like maybe they see some performance improvements and stuff, but it's like the stuff that helps the spaghetti get managed. That was really challenging to just say, no, listen, we have to do this thing, right? And you have...
Well, it's kind of like in cities how we have sewers that are sometimes hundreds of years old and then they collapse and we get giant craters in the road and people are like, why didn't people fix this? Well, how many of us get excited about replacing sewer infrastructure?
Under using the our tax money to replace sewer infrastructure, right? It's like, well, it's got to get done. So it's like the same thing in tech, right? It's like, well, no, I want the snazzy, cool new widget that does XYZ because like, that's something worthy of like an amazing marketing announcement that we can, you know, put out there. So I think like the balance was reached at Shopify, and like, it's a very sturdy, performant platform. It's why I'm building on top of it. But it was like in the thick of it, it does take a while to get your ideas, you know, out there and to get approved for the non-sexy stuff.
Well, and you were working with very big personalities, right? Like these are people who are driven to get attention, to get their ideas listened to get approval for their pitches. And maybe that isn't exactly who you are. You know, maybe you're happiest creating and you're happiest working with customers. But what was that like? How did you grow during that time? There must have been quite a few moments of deep discomfort or even suffering, I'm guessing, just having to deal with all that friction.
Absolutely, right? Like processes kept changing. Like I was at Shopify before, I think it was around 1,000 people, and I left when it was ten thousand, if not more. And so like, imagine how many processes have to change and how many people shift roles and all that stuff throughout that time. It's not easy to just be like this up and coming product manager trying to figure out like the right way to do things and like trying to advocate for, you know, ideas and all that stuff when like there's just so much, you know, that you have to, like boxes you have to check, people you have to like discuss things with. And like, you know, the standard steps that go into like working in a corporate culture of like, well, we need this level of approval and like you need to validate this with this. And like, there's some things you will never know if it's the right idea. Like you have a gut instinct and you have some sort of metrics, but it's like really, really hard to like say absolutely for a fact, this is going to make us millions of dollars. Like we have to ship it. You know, and so like, yeah, there was this huge competition when it came to, I think, product management at Shopify. Like, you know, you're working for an exciting company that's, you know, making a ton of money in like the boom of e-commerce, and people want to be on the coolest projects. They want to be, you know, associated with having built something that stands for like greatness, because then it means you level up in your career at Shopify or elsewhere or whatever. You get to be part of like these big announcements and stuff. And I think I was not that kind of personality at all. Like I'm on you know, podcasts and I'm on LinkedIn and I'm all on these things now because I'm very passionate about my business and like building something that people recognize as like quality and stuff. But it's like really hard to do for me when I'm working for someone else, you know? So that was just like a struggle for me to like really get out there and be like, I'm here, like this is what I'm working on and it's going to be great.
What are the moments for you where time stops and you're just in your absolute zone with a customer or with your product development? Tell me a little bit more about that. Like what really makes you light up?
Yeah, I love like lately, and I like don't know why this happened, but I guess it's just like, you know, you're in the space for so long, people start to recognize that you are, you know, an expert at that space. And so I get into customer calls lately with like the most interesting people. Like I just talked to a chef the other day who's thinking of launching a product and he's like, how would you do it? Or like, what's the way? And I'm designing workflows. I'm designing, you know, what I think the way the end-to-end workflow would be with Shopify, with our app, with other apps, you know, like just building them the system and saying, hey, like, I think this is how I would run it and like how you're going to see success. And I'm just like in the zone, you know, building this thing out and like just being part of that journey and seeing a product launch or like, you know, them get up and running. Ah, it's just like, I can't get enough of it, you know? And so like, I'm like probably mostly on, you know, helping support customers and stuff for like 60-70% of my day.
Well, I saw your post on LinkedIn the other day where you were saying, you know, as your company expands, you've been told you don't have to be on customer support, but it's actually one of those areas that lights you up, that it totally engages you.
Yeah. Oh, so I just like, I love it. Like, this is the stuff I didn't get a lot of when I was working for someone else, because like, yes, you're building products for customers, but it's like hard to get a hold of customers, you know, like they don't really come to you once they're using your app. And then the first people they talk to are usually salespeople or some sort of, or customer support at a big org. So I never got to like really talk to them. We had some really good research sessions once in a while, but this is like, you get exposed to every single person who installs your app and has a question and whatever. And then I had this person come to us, I think beginning of this week, who was just like, I just want you to know that I just installed your app and like I've been looking for this for 4 weeks now and I tried all these apps that had like thousands of reviews and they didn't do what I wanted. So just share this review with people. And I'm like, can you write this in our app store like listing? Cause like it was just like, it made my day, you know? Or people who, you know, mentioned me by name saying she helped me and whatever. And I'm just like, I never think that's a waste of time, right? I'm always like super engaged. And I just like showed me a lot about the kind of thing I need in my career to be happy and to like keep showing up every day versus, yeah, the playing the politics, right? Of like, who needs to hear about this? And like, how many meetings do we have to have about this? And so on and so forth, right? Like that stuff gets old. That stuff does not engage me.
For sure. But what role would you say fear of failure has played? I mean, early in our careers, typically many of us are terrified to fail and we avoid it. And sometimes we lose out on opportunities. Now you're a co-founder of DownPay. You're doing phenomenal work. What would you say to people about the value of failure and trying new things?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't lie and say, oh my goodness, everyone, I have like the confidence of like, you know, whatever, whoever. I still struggle with confidence and with like belief in what I'm, like anything that I'm doing, that I'm going to do it well and that it's going to be successful. I think I have had fear of failure through every point in my career pivots. And it's, you gotta get through it. You have to try something. If you don't feel comfortable where you are, if you're unhappy, if you're unengaged, the fear of failure is the thing that's going to hold you back from at least attempting something, some different path. And so like, for me, I come from, you know, a family of not risk takers, you know, and I quit my corporate job last April to take on my company full time. And I also bought a house a month earlier. And my dad was like, what? and he was like, you know, he's the most risk averse person I know, I think, where he's just like, he's always been worried about like making sure that everything's going to go, and I'm doing this crazy thing, which is probably the craziest thing I've ever done in my life. But then reflecting back on it almost 365 days later, I'm just like, all the signs pointed to like, you're crazy and all this stuff. And you just hustle and you work through it. And every, you know, you look at the weeks that have passed and you go, okay, like, did I make progress in the right direction? Is my fear based on reality or is it based on, you know, just like things that don't exist? And you just keep pushing through it, you know? Otherwise, yeah, like you, I would have never started a company. You know, it was the right time for me to find the co-founder I found, who's amazing. And, you know, I couldn't do this without him. But if I hadn't taken that leap, like, it would have been, we would have been dead in the water. Like, he was full time on it.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about your co-founder. What's his name and what role has he played?
Yeah, like, so his name's Dennis, and he is also ex-Shopify, and he had been in e-commerce for even longer than I had. Like, he was originally building apps on Shopify before even working at Shopify, like, original app store, you know, back in the day. And he had his own journey through, like, working at Shopify, then, like, trying a different company for a while. And, like, I caught him in his, like, little six-month break where he, you know, felt burnt out, needed a break. And I caught him and said, like, I'm super unhappy with my work. So I had left Shopify, but was working somewhere else. And I'm like, oh, I need something that like is more engaging and whatever. And so I convinced him to like build this app for me. And so he's my technical co-founder. He builds the foundations of everything we use and do with DownPay. And yeah, it's just like the perfect person at the right time. And if I was too afraid to say, I'm going to quit my job and do this thing, that would have fell flat. And I wouldn't feel the way I feel today saying this was worth the risk, you know?
So having a co-founder, it's a bit of moral support as well. And obviously,
yes,
the creativity, the energy, the resource that goes into it. But just having that can-do spirit and going forward.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think both of us are more risk averse than like most co-founders, I guess, or like most founders.
So maybe when you put you together, your willingness to take on risk is enough for one person.
Exactly.
And then the rest of you keeps you honest, keeps you safe.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Where like, I think we talked about that a while where we're like, we would never let this company get to the point where it's just like, oh my goodness, like it's failing. We owe so much money, blah, blah, blah. Like, we're just not the kinds of people that are going to just like dig a hole that deep and, you know, kind of like limit ourselves. And yeah, we're just very level headed. And I think the other thing is like, we're just taking our time. Like, we're bootstrapped. We didn't take VC money. We didn't take any capital. We're just trying to build something that really gives us time for our personal life and our personal aspirations, not just, you know, work 80 hours a week forever because we want to build a $1 billion company, you know? And like, that is how we both went into this and said, no, we want like a really comfortable life that also means we can work on things we love and still have, you know, a family and friends and, you know, everything else.
And this is really important because I have a feeling that a lot of listeners relate to this. We see the stereotype of the entrepreneur, someone who sleeps in their office, they live to make their first $1 billion. They're obsessed with growth. Great. Okay. There's a place in the world for those people. We hear about them all the time. I get it. I get the appeal. But there are probably hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs like you, Diana, who they have a passion, they're creative, they love to support good businesses, they love to help customers, and they also want to have a life. So what advice would you give to those who want to start their own venture in tech or e-commerce or just entrepreneurship in general, but they think maybe they're not that type A extreme personality? You're clearly living it. So what advice would you give them?
I mean, yeah, I do not put in 80-hour work weeks. I am, you know, I'm in my 30s, so like I don't have that energy anymore. Who in their 30s has that energy anymore? And, you know, like my big advice for that is like, think about your end goal. You know, what is it that you really want and why are you starting this business? Like, you can turn a hobby into a business easily, but will it make you happy? Like, that's up to you to decide. You can also, you know, want to end the corporate life and try to like set yourself up for success and see if you can prove that you can do it, you know? And like, that's a lot of what I did. I wanted to prove to myself that I could figure this out, and we're getting there. But yeah, like, I think a big piece that a lot of people miss is like, they look at LinkedIn and they look at, you know, all these, you know, people raising money and millions of dollars in capital and all that stuff. And all that's doing is putting more pressure on yourself to, you know, deliver some valuation that True. Is astronomical. And so, yeah, for me, it was like, okay, make sure I have enough money in the bank to like support myself for a while I try to build this thing out. And then make sure I know what I really want as my end goal. And like, my end goal is, you know, to have a sustainable business that's helping people everywhere, wherever I can help them do this thing, provide a really high quality experience that also fulfills me when I go into work every day. And it just like engages with the e-commerce community in like a meaningful way. And have a personal life outside of that. I love playing video games. I love, you know, exercising and all that stuff. And make sure that that doesn't get damaged in any way while I do this thing. And one of the really great conversations I had with my co-founder early on was when, you know, I was feeling like, okay, I quit my job. Like, I gotta hustle, gotta do this thing. And he's like, listen, like, we are bootstrapped, we're trying to just pace ourselves, and some of the things we can already take advantage of is the flexible lifestyle that we want to lead, right? So if you want to work out for an hour and a half this morning and not start work until 11, like, that's what you can afford to do for yourself because you chose this path, right? Yeah. And not feeling guilty that this isn't your regular 9 to 5. And so I don't work 80 hours a week, but I do work at 9 p.m. on one night for an hour or whatever, because I get to go for a walk with my dog in the middle of the day, or I get to take a half day here to, you know, do something with my partner or whatever. And like, that's what really got me excited about the entrepreneur journey. And like, those later night calls or whatever, it's like, doesn't mean anything because I've balanced the personal things that I needed to feel like a human being with the work, right? It's never like gonna overtake, because I'm mindful to just like make sure I'm doing the right things for my health, you know, for my mind and everything before I say, okay, let's sit down for work and, you know, knock this stuff out for hours on end. So really think through like the things you need and then the things you want out of your life before yeah. making this leap, but absolutely make the leap because it's amazing.
Absolutely.
It's enjoyable.
And you mentioned the word bootstrapped, and of course that idea is you're basically building when you can with your own money. You're not depending yep. on VC money, as you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit about where you want to see DownPay in the next 5 years or even the next year? What are some goals you're excited to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, it would just be amazing to just keep seeing a variety of businesses come on. Like, it's obviously super exciting to see like larger brands, you know, use your app, you know? So when I see installs from like bigger brands, I'm like, ooh, you know, like, I can't believe they nice. Heard about us. Or, you know, you have a call with somebody that you recognize or you love the product that they sell. And so like, I, you know, my big goal is just like, I really want to set us up as the best in class app to do this on Shopify and to like be the solution to these types of businesses and get that awareness out there for, you know, the fact that we exist. And, you know, like that review I mentioned to you where people were like, I've tried so many apps and like finally found yours. And I'm like, I don't want that to be the thing anymore. I want it to just be like, oh yeah, we know where to go because this one solves the problem we need to solve. Yeah. It should be like way less friction, which I'm like, okay, how do I do that? Which is the the hard battle to fight.
Yeah. Well, if customers want to contact you, they should go to the DownPay site or your LinkedIn. You know, are those the best yes. ways to reach you?
Yeah.
And we'll put those in the show notes. And then let's say I'm a customer who would like to shop from artisans or e-commerce providers that specifically provide DownPay as a service. Is there a way to search for that? Can I look at vendors who use DownPay and then choose to shop from them specifically?
Wow, you just created a feature request that we don't have yet.
Well, the reason I thought of this is...
That's cool.
I thought I'm probably somebody who... The reason I thought of it is I'm someone who would love to buy more well-made products. And most of the time, I just assume that I'll buy a stopgap. I'll buy the cheaper version that maybe I don't love, but it's all I can afford or it's what I have access to. If I had a list of online shops that used your service, I could actually pick out really important pieces of furniture or artisan objects or beautifully designed products that I want and I don't mind waiting for because it's worth it. And as a customer, right, just having that option and the searchability would be huge for me.
That's great feedback. No, I mean, it's something we definitely want to pursue. It's so true. Like if there's just so much noise out there, and that's, I guess, the downside of democratizing commerce. Everybody sells, you know, duplicates of the same thing. That's really good feedback to hear. You know, like it's true, you know, working with customers who do custom personalized things, like they tend to be like very mindfully built and, you know, you pay for what you get, which is quality and which is like care into those products. So yeah, definitely going to take that one away.
Well, here's another idea too. There's so much coming out in terms of AI enhanced creation. So I'm thinking specifically, you know, having the fashion design background, there's better and more accessible fashion designs that are custom made more and more now. And that's becoming within reach to the average person in terms of price point, accessibility. But I bet you that would be a great candidate for DownPay because I'm someone who would love to buy custom-made fashion designs for myself with little alterations or things that I personally love. And knowing where to go for that, I could say, okay, I'm going to make this down payment and then I'm going to have this beautiful piece in 6 months even or 4 months, right, whatever it may be. But I don't mind because it's something I can only buy there and I can't buy it anywhere else. That's an immediate thing. And with AI, of course, changes to patterns, pattern making and production,
yeah,
are becoming much more accessible to the average person. So I see a natural fit for DownPay there too, is just more shops, more online sellers, artisans wanting that option because they would provide maybe custom made tailored garments is a great example.
Oh, we see it a lot too, yeah, with wedding dresses and bridesmaid dresses. Like we have several customers who custom make these gorgeous gowns, you know, and like they have to be made a specific way for a specific person. And so, yeah, like that's the thing, right? Like who wouldn't want something very personalized? And I think that that's also something that I think is very impactful for selling clothing online where you don't know if it's going to fit you and stuff. And like, sure, you can try it, like you can buy it, try it, all that stuff, and then return it if you don't want. But that's like a pretty frustrating experience to just, and super wasteful and not, you know, great for carbon footprint. So, you know, like providing your size and building something off of that. Like how cool is that to say like, this will fit me perfectly. You know, it's something that I'm going to care about for a long time. It's like a staple piece or something, right? So I love the idea that this is becoming more commonplace, you know, and building something custom is just like, yeah, it means something more to you, right? Because you picked everything out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this a lot more as I've learned about DownPay. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you want to share today?
I mean, we covered so much and we've gone so far. But yeah, no, like another, just like a cool other e-commerce trend or like the impact that I've seen with e-commerce has been on the service industry as well. Like just recently, we've seen such an uptick in like businesses who rent things out. Once again, like rentals being something way more sustainable and like you use the same thing over and over again versus like something new every time. So I love that. And it's like deposits are like a natural fit there. So it's been cool to see those businesses come on. A lot of bouncy castle rentals. Very, very niche. But then there's also services like, you know, treatments, like massage, therapy. There's even like a couple customers that sell like car detailing, you know? And wow. So once again, like services are a whole space where you don't charge somebody before services are rendered. You charge them when they complete their appointment. So that's been just such a natural fit for us as well, which is cool. And it's cool to see that, like, I don't think like Shopify was like the first thing in mind when you think of services, you know, because you usually think physical products that ship out and stuff. But it's just like, yeah, it's been really cool to see like they're launching, you know, sites for like beauty or whatnot and doing treatments and all that. And we're just along for the ride. We're like, yeah, absolutely. Like that makes sense. Take a, you know, 20% deposit so people don't cancel and then book your time and so on and so forth. So really neat niches that are just like unfolding for us.
That's fantastic. It's been so great having you on today, Diana. I've learned a lot and I love your passion and your energy, but also your commitment to balance and getting outside. I relate. I deeply relate. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a great, great chat.
If you love Access Ideas, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and review us on Podchaser via the link in our show notes or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. Tell your friends about the podcast too. Until next time, thanks for listening to Access Ideas.